Thank you all for coming. I'm Christy George. I'm an independent TV producer in Portland, Oregon. And I'm working on a book about climate change and social change, and this is sort of a related panel. We're going to talk about the argument about taking action to combat climate change that is not made very much, but may be coming soon as a more powerful argument. And that is the question of morality, ethics, fairness, justice. Each panelist here, and I'm going to introduce them in a second, is going to talk for about five to seven minutes, something like that. I might ask a follow-up question in that round, but I want to open it up to Q&A as soon as possible so that you can all ask your questions. To my right is Dawn
Kopic.
Thank you. I forgot to ask that off mic. She's the co-founder and legislative director of LEAF, the Lindquist Appalachian Environmental Fellowship. She's a Christian environmental activist. And then Alex Felt is a lecturer at the University of Tennessee in Knoxville and the philosophy department. And Joe Rome is with climateprogress.org. He's actually the founding editor of that. And as we learned yesterday, he is the chief science editor for a brand new TV series starting on Showtime this fall. Is that right, Joe? This fall, called The Years of Living Dangerously. Check it out. Looks really great. We've heard the scientific argument about climate change for decades, many decades, and it is very convincing for people who understand complicated science and for me, probably for you, most of us in this room, but the science is not only complicated, but it's also framed with a lot of uncertainty, and that does not help make a compelling case for the average person. And certainly we have not found that even though the science is in and quite definitive, that people are changing their behavior. Then we've been hearing the economic arguments for also some decades now, and that case is pretty slam dunk as well, and yet that's not really leading to a lot of change. So we're going to look at what social scientists, a lot of them are now looking at, which is some different frames that have worked in other issues over the years. So I want to start with Dawn. And Dawn, if you would talk a little bit about the morality argument in religion.
All right. LEAF is based out of Knoxville, and thank you all for being here in Tennessee. Welcome. It was founded 5 or 6 years ago. And it is my belief that climate change happens, and it's real, and that it needs to be addressed immediately. That is not an official statement of LEAF's, however. We don't talk about climate change. We talk about Earth stewardship, and the reason we don't talk about climate change, and it was co-founded with myself and Pat Hudson, who is actually a freelance travel writer and also a reference librarian in the past. Now she's retired, I guess, and does a little bit of writing. But anyway, we're drinking the greeny Kool-Aid and have been for years. Drive Priuses, recycle, all that. But we're also drinking the Jesus Kool-Aid, and we go to church together, and we have been always. And one of the things that we think is that the scientific arguments are persuasive to a whole lot of learning styles and a whole lot of thinking styles of people, and we already have all those people in the tent. So what are we going to do about the rest of the tent? And so I will tell you that it's been my experience. I work a whole lot with churches. You're probably not going to convert those people by pummeling them with more science. And for Christians, while the scientific argument gives rise to concern, it gives rise to spiritual and moral concern. And that spiritual and moral concern does not require that you believe that there's global warming. It requires that you believe that you be a steward of the earth, and to do that will in fact solve global warming. So there's no reason for us to talk about global warming because, or climate change, because that alienates some of our base and they need to take baby steps. And somehow when you're advocating, it's very and this is true certainly for religious zealots as well, it's, the approach seems to be, or it's very tempting to say, here is what I have, buy 100% of it as deep as I believe it right now. And that's really not the way people's minds work, and that's not the way LEAF works. So let me tell you a little bit about us. This is a statement of who we are from our website. We're tnleaf.org. We're a fellowship of Christians who take action for Tennessee's environment. If there's something two volunteer moms know how to do, it is limit the scope of your endeavor. So we just deal with Tennessee. We just deal with Christians. For when it comes to legislative matters, we just deal with mountaintop removal coal mining, because if there was ever environmental low-hanging fruit, that's it. That's me and that's Pat. Some journalist took that picture. I don't know why we're in front of a library, but that kind of... And these are the packets that 6 or 7 years ago we started giving away to churches that we were not trying to be political. Some of the materials from those packets are in the back. The stuff on the right side of the table, people who will really read it and use it can take, and we can. Me and my son, Leo, our children have all cycled through. He's in the back right-hand corner. He's a high school senior. He's the youth director of LEAF, and we've had 4, and he's the youngest of our children, and I don't know what I'm do when he goes to college next year. But anyway, so LEAF is here, and those are the packets we give away. We have services. That's a Mountain Sunday service at the University of Tennessee, one of the chapels there. So we have service materials on our website, responsive readings, sermon ideas, and hymn suggestions. That's one of the mountains that's a poster child. I took that with my phone, and it was on the front of the Tennessean newspaper. But that's Zeb Mountain, and some people like to say we don't have mountaintop removal in Tennessee. I lobby. That's what I do, Christian lobbyists. That's a really interesting dichotomy. But they will say, oh, we don't really do mountaintop removal coal mining. And when they say that, they mean, well, we take the rubble and we pat it back on the top where it stays for about 45 minutes. But I just say, and rather than digging into the weeds of that, I say, well, what happened to the top of that one? Because God doesn't build mesas in the Appalachians. If you're fond of streams, which we are, all of the leaflets, as we are sometimes known, are outdoors people. We paddle and hike and bike, and then the qualitative difference between a man-made stream that's off a mountaintop removal coal site that's supposed to carry water away, but the water just doesn't really obey engineers very well. The one on the right is a God-made stream. Qualitatively, it seems pretty obvious to us. There's a statement of the United Methodist Church against mountaintop removal coal mining. There's the Unitarians. There's the Presbyterians. There's the Evangelical Lutherans, the Episcopalians, and the Southern Baptist Environmental Climate Initiative. There's some of our publicity. We are all about some God. That was a billboard. About 6 or 8 of those were around the city of Nashville shortly before one of our votes. We do partner with godless environmentalists, in part because we don't have any money, and in part because, you know, if the Lord said to feed the children, should the Christian organizations partner with the secular organizations that are feeding the children? Absolutely. Same with the environment. And we enjoy and have made a lot of good friends in the environmental community. But anyway, NRDC paid for that for us. Thank you, NRDC. And that's where to find us on the web. So I think a lot about the salvation. You know, everybody's going, okay, I'm banging my head. How are we going to get people to listen? Well, look at the I think it's really important to look at the foundations for the creation care that Leo is handing out for you guys. Leo, did you do that? All right, he's going to do it. He's going to give you a one-page handout that includes the scriptural foundations, and most people think we're just hanging on one little verse, kind of like, you know, the people who hate gay people do, but we're not. If you read at it, if you read, you know, these are just my thoughts on the biblical foundations. Every one of those bullet points is a whole different theological basis. Earth stewardship is a
is a primary theme throughout the Bible. There's a copy of the Green Bible back there. If you've never seen it, you need to look at it. It has all the verses that refer to the earth and the natural world and stewardship in green, with a foreword by Desmond Tutu. So it's a pretty cool thing. So really that's all I have to say until you have questions.
I want to ask you one quick question. In 2005, we met in Austin, Texas, and one of our speakers was Bill Moyers, whose speech to the group was that we need to talk about climate change in religious areas and churches in the South, in particular, as the story of the Ark, and that we are in fact in that situation with climate change. I just wonder what you thought about that.
You do it.
Yeah, we do talk about it. And when we talk about Noah and the Ark, one of the things that's really interesting, the rainbow after this flood was a symbol of the covenant between God and the animals and all of creation, that he would never destroy us again. So if God holds the animals and creation in such esteem that he makes covenant with them as well as with us, then that is just one more indication of the love and ownership of the earth that God feels. So yes, we do that, and I absolutely agree with Bill Moyers. We get covered like a bell or a whistle, like a sidebar story. And you know, you get a new science article, and that's like a big deal. Everybody wants to talk about that. Well, you know, all of those denominational statements should have been a story. The people in those denominations, some of them don't know that their denomination has taken a statement on this issue, and a lot of them don't know. And you put it on the religion page, and different people will read it. That is what I think.
Thank you. An aside, before I introduce Joe Rome, in 1998 when we met in Chattanooga, that was the first panel I ever moderated for SEJ, and Joe was on my panel. Is that cool? Anyway, Joe has blogged a lot about the morality case for climate change, and one of your columns was about Thomas Jefferson and the founders and their invocation of God in terms of the environment. Take it away.
Pass me the connector, and I'll
great.
See if it'll work. It won't be.
One moment. And grab Alex. Grab your.
We'll be coming in.
There we go. My good.
Beautiful.
So I have a little cartoon.
Get the mic closer.
Yes, the planet got destroyed, but for a beautiful moment in time, we created a lot of value for shareholders. And just only going to show one slide. Because I think this slide captures the morality of what we're doing, or the lack of morality. This is based on a study that came out this year. The purple line here is the reconstructed temperature since the dawn of modern civilization. And temperature's pretty flat. And it was that stable climate that allowed agriculture to, you know, grow to a point where it could feed 7 billion people and, you know, millions and then ultimately billions of people picked where to live based on where a livable climate was. We are now here, and we are headed up here in a century or so, give or take, and nothing like this has ever happened, not only to humans, but there's never been a temperature rise and a change in climate this quickly. All right, I think that's all I'm going to do for that, and I will. One thing I want to say is, for those who are interested in doing stories on this, one very good person to talk to is Catherine Hayhoe, who is a climate scientist in Texas and an evangelical. And she's actually part of the TV series, Years Living Dangerously. And she's very good. She's married to an evangelical preacher, and she goes and talks to, you know, evangelical churches and others about climate science and how that's, you know, part of her, consistent with her faith. One of the points I wanted to make is that, You know, morality is not just the realm of religion. I have a quote here. I fully subscribe to the judgment of those writers who maintain that of all the differences between man and the lower animals, the moral sense or conscience is by far the most important. And that was Charles Darwin, 1871, The Descent of Man. You know, the so what I have long thought that the moral argument was the central one, in part because I think most of the great social causes in this country have been won and lost on moral issues, and I think that this is, you know, as you can see from that figure, you know, it seems clear to me that if we don't act soon, then, you know, within decades, a large fraction of the world's then 9 billion people will find themselves living in places where their once stable climate has been destroyed, either because it's too hot or arid, the land is no longer arable, their glacially fed rivers are drying up, or the seas are rising too fast. And the overwhelming majority of the people who are suffering in this country and especially other countries will be people who contributed little or nothing whatsoever to the problem. And that, I think, would be the greatest injustice in all of human history. And I use a metaphor, you know, that every day we are stealing from our children's future to maintain our unsustainable carbon-fueled prosperity. And knowing that the cost of action is far less than the cost of inaction. And in that sense, the global economy is a giant Ponzi scheme. And if we don't act knowing what we know, then we are all Bernie Madoffs. And climatologists, you know, have who are pretty reticent. Scientists are not your alarmists in general. As I think one person said, if a scientist becomes alarmed, you ought to be really alarmed, because they trade in facts and numbers and figures. And you know, even a guy, once reticent climatologist like Dr. Lonnie Thompson, who's the glaciologist expert, wrote a couple years ago about why climatologists are speaking out. And he said, virtually all of us are now convinced that global warming poses a clear and present danger to civilization. And that's why you're seeing climatologists like James Hansen and Jason Box getting arrested for joint action. So stealing from our children is immoral. The Constitution Law Foundation pointed out that the most succinct systematic treatment of intergenerational principles left to us by the founders is that which was provided by Thomas Jefferson in his famous September 6, 1789 letter to James Madison. And I can't do justice to his argument. I'll just read one quote from it, because he gets into legalese, but the argument is very powerful. The question is whether future generations are bound to consider the preceding generations having had a right to eat up the whole soil of their country in the course of a life. And he says everyone will say no, that the soil is the gift of God to the living as much as it had been paid to the deceased generation, and that the laws of nature impose no obligation on them to pay this debt. So this notion that we do owe the future the livable climate that we gave him. And I urge people to read the whole piece, the whole letter by Jefferson. The thing that I noticed being in Washington, D.C., is how the moral argument works. And there's a very good example. There's a couple of Salon pieces, which one on 2011, Gay Rights, Surprise Weapon, Morality. What moved gay marriage into the mainstream in 2011 was morality. They did this, and it is a lesson that the gay revolution holds for any progressive movement, not by asking for tolerance. They didn't ask people to accept gay marriage by holding their moral noses. Rather, they set out to change people's minds about what is moral, what is fair, and what is equitable. And, you know, what was impossible to imagine 10 years ago is now a complete flip on the politics because of the argument for marriage equality. We have the civil rights movement, we have the anti-slavery movement, we have women's suffrage movement. These are all movements that were long-term social movements that were won on moral grounds. I'll just end with two quotes. One, when Stevenson, who's a great writer in this field, wrote a piece on the new abolitionist, global warming is the great moral crisis of our time. And he quotes Frederick Douglass in 1857, if there's no struggle, there is no progress. Those who profess to favor freedom and yet deprecate agitation are men who want crops without plowing up the ground. They want rain without thunder and lightning. They want the ocean without the awful roar of its many waters. This struggle may be a moral one or it may be a physical one, and it may be both moral and physical, but it must be a struggle. Power concedes nothing without a demand. It never did and it never will. And I'll just end with a quote that perhaps is the most relevant for SEJ. This is from Edward R. Murrow in his See It Now program, March 9th, 1954. This is no time for men who oppose Senator McCarthy's methods to keep silent. We can deny our heritage and our history, but we cannot escape responsibility for the result.
And that, if I recall correctly, turned the tide on the McCarthy situation. We heard something similar from Walter Cronkite about Vietnam. So there's some precedent for activist journalism. Joe, I want you to, I don't even know how to pronounce usufruct.
Oh, man. Yeah.
But it's really what you just said. It's essentially, it's an idea of law that requires not using it all. But you do it.
Yeah, well, I would. We're now getting to legal term. I think the question is whether someone who owns property can destroy that property, and the owner, the next owner. The question is who really owns the land. For instance, is it through the purchase of property? Do you own the land so much that you can actually ravage it? Or in fact, from an intergenerational equity and therefore legal point of view, it is beyond, you know, human morality for you to destroy the essence of what it is that you owned for a while, to the point where it can't be used by the next person to have it.
And this was what the founders of this country believed, is that you cannot use it, correct? I mean, the founders are often invoked, and I just want to make it clear that this was their concept.
Yeah, well, this was Jefferson, and I think that it doesn't, you know, there are certain groups in this country that love to talk about the Constitution and the founding fathers, but I have no doubt as to what the founding fathers would think if they saw what we were doing today. I mean, obviously they would be horrified. They'd be horrified at what's going on in Washington right now. But you know, they would be horrified. I mean, obviously Jefferson was, you know, an agricultural type person. But I think that it's, you know, they would never have imagined the rapaciousness. The only guy I didn't quote, I should have brought the quotes, is from Teddy Roosevelt. You know, some of his great speeches on what it means to be a progressive, and he talks about this at length. Just it's the total, you know, immorality of letting the corporations you know, destroy the land for short-term economic gain. And you know, that was back in the day when a Republican could be the first progressive.
Joe, one quick question from the audience is where will they find your columns on this, your blogs?
They can go to Climate Progress, and rather than using my own search engine, you can just use Google. I mean, if you put in Climate Progress and Jefferson, then, you know, you'll find that post.
Great. Thank you. Alex, I want you to take us through a little bit of the philosophers thinking about this, because this gets us, I think, to questions like carbon taxes and cap and trade, but the process by which you get there is a sort of a moral reasoning through philosophy.
So I may end up being a bit of a downer here, potentially.
Because I was so upbeat?
Both of you are very upbeat in the sense of there's a clear moral argument that's going to do work. And there's a sense in which the moral argument can potentially, I think, get in the way. And I think it's more related to how we conceive what the moral argument is. And so this is something I always tell my students when we talk about all sorts of hot-button social issues. And they go, well, Yeah, okay, so that's the argument that tells me that's the right thing to do, but it's not going to convince anybody. And so there's kind of a thinking of a moral argument as a philosophical argument that points out this is the right thing, and then there's the I want to actually get there. And sometimes it seems like maybe we need something slightly different. And so it's difficult working in academia at times because you have to jump between I want to be an activist, but now I need to actually give the clear argument. And so hopefully I can get at why there might be some reasons to think more about what the moral argument really is. And so climate change ends up being a really big problem from a more philosophical point of view because you basically have the ultimate collective action problem. It's something that if one person acts, it's not really going to matter. You need the collective organization to come together. You need all of the large emitters to come together. And no one has sort of good self-interested reasons to act. So from a roughly rational point of view, it's somewhat rational for people to not engage in the action because they're not going to get the benefit relative to the cost they might put in. And so a lot of people who work on collective action say the only way you can get a group of people in that scenario to act is if you give them what they like to call sort of extra rational or moral reasons. You sell them on things that go, you know, I'm not going to necessarily get something from this, but I have good reasons because I ought to help somebody or I ought to do this. And so that's kind of then led into a lot of talk about how would you spell that out? And so philosophically, you kind of get a couple camps on why climate change is morally wrong. And so what I want to say from the outset is there's a clear consensus. If you throw out maybe one or two people in the academic literature, climate change is morally wrong. The problem, though, is they don't agree on why, and that means they don't agree on what the appropriate response is. And so if the response you're trying to get is just do something, it seems like you've got something there. But if you think that we need to actually do this certain policy, you run into a problem. And this plays out a lot in the arguments we see in climate policy related to the developed world and the developing world. Right? The developing world wants to say, it's on you. You owe more. You've got to do more. You have a moral obligation. And the developed world has often, at times, put forward arguments that say, no, we have a shared moral obligation. And so what this does is it comes from, what do you think is going on that's wrong? And so one way to look at it is to say it's about justice and fairness, right? So you appeal to these ideas. But the problem there is some people want to use that to say, well, what is fair is we can't take historical emissions into consideration because we didn't know better, or you have to have an argument about where would be the point where it's reasonable to hold people accountable for the past. And then you get other situations where they say, no, we need to hold accountable. And so there's a question of what you understand justice is asking. So it's one thing to say it's unjust. But then there's the worry of how do you cash that out in terms of action, right? And so if you're interested in what's the appropriate policy response, who owes more, who should do more, if you take these sort of justice and equity-based versions, you can get versions that say, we in the developed world don't owe more than people in the developing world. And for some people, that seems really either weird or sort of problematic. And so another view says, let's not look at the moral problem as one of justice and fairness. Let's look at it as one of human rights. That climate change will violate people's human rights, and you can't ever compensate for that. You can't ever give people money for that. You can't give them any form of compensation. And so it's on the people who can make a difference now to stop that from ever happening. And that's where you start to, I think, get arguments that push more a lot in saying the developed world has the stronger responsibility because it's not about fairness. It's not about these things. It's about human rights. And that's the problem. And the only people who can stop the human rights violations, whether or not you caused them, have a responsibility to step up. And so you get kind of some traction there. And so at the end of the day, I think the human rights one works a little better. That's where I do my academic research from. I'm working on developing that. But at the end of the day, I think the responsibility question of who owes what needs a lot more consideration, both philosophically and potentially within some of the activism. Because it's one thing to say, we all need to do something. And I think a lot of people are put off, and when I've talked to my students, it seems they're put off on action because they feel there's a moral argument, I need to do something. But I don't know what it is I'm supposed to do. And so there's this worry that the appeal to morality only gets you so far, and then it's a, I don't know what to do. And then the last thing that I want to note here that throws a wrench in it is a lot of people, because climate change is collective and what we call an aggregative harm, they look at it and say, it doesn't matter what I do. My emissions don't cause climate change. If I don't go drive my car, that doesn't stop climate change. And so it's trying to find moral arguments that can also break through that and say, no, you actually have a responsibility. And I think here the big thing is breaking causation away from the discussion, that you're not morally responsible due to you caused it. You're morally responsible because other people are being significantly harmed, and then you need to step in and stop that, for the same reasons why we engage in humanitarian intervention in other countries. There's a severe harm. We didn't cause it, but we have an obligation to step in and do something about it.
Great. I want to do a quick follow-up on that, and that is this notion of, I'm going to call it interglobal morality, to play off intergenerational morality that Joe was talking about. And really what, you know, the goods that we buy for the most part now are manufactured in places like China and India, who are being asked to shoulder a burden and are resisting and saying, no, wait a second, you know, we haven't been polluting nearly as long as the developed world. But it seems to me that we have outsourced our pollution to the developing world. Not only will they get the biggest burden of climate change. So does that argument work?
I think it does, and you see it actually a lot with some of the philosophical literature who are interested in the fairness question and who want to engage it that way. At the end of the day, for me at least, if I separate out and just take it from this more sort of human rights, or say it doesn't matter who caused it, it doesn't matter who outsourced it, what matters is who is able to do something about it. And I think that if you frame it that way, it becomes clear that the people who are most able to do something about it are the people in the developed world anyway. And so that still then shifts the sort of the moral burden on those of us in the developed world to either not buy some of the products, be more conscious about the consumption chain of where things are coming from. And then I think the biggest thing is, once you recognize there's a moral obligation, and you also recognize that even if I try to be as green as possible, that in itself won't make a difference, it leads to that there's a moral obligation as citizens, and here I think it's as citizens of the world, to get people to do what they ought to be doing.
Great. I want to give the panelists a chance to react to each other. Don?
I had a couple of thoughts. I think Joe got to the root of the problem about, are we entitled to use up all that we have? What does a deed to real estate really mean? And particularly in Tennessee, working with the legislature, one of the biggest anti-regulation, pro-blow the top off a mountain is they own it. You know, why can't they blow it into a bunch of little gravels? And that actually is an incredibly persuasive argument in the Tennessee legislature. And our response, and I think for a lot of people that are really pretty injured by religion, so when I say this is the Christian approach to, if I say that to a bunch of Christians, they're just all okay with that. But to people that are a very diverse group, I know a lot of people get a little bit, get their back up. Everything I say has a basis in general morality. I frame it in a Christian frame. That is the most meaningful for me. But if that is troublesome to you, please understand it is transferable. And a lot of it is transferable to other faiths as well. And there's a wonderful group that works on climate change called Interfaith Power and Light, and we work with them. Also, but anyway, that said, this business of who owns it, you know, on my business card, it has the psalm on it that says, the earth is the Lord's and all that is in it. And so I think we own our real estate, and you know, I got 50 acres of most beautiful East Tennessee farmland in the world, and I own that in the very same way that I own that boy right back there. You know, it doesn't really belong to me. It's mine to take care of. It is a huge responsibility. I can be proud of how it turns out, or I can be incredibly irresponsible and cause irreparable damage, but it's not mine. Now, and then the other thing that Alex was getting at is, well, whose responsibility is it? We've got some paradigms that led to this problem, and one is that we're not Buddhist enough, okay? We are all one. This idea that I can be a big capitalist consuming pig in America and that Indonesia can flood and that is not my problem, that is just so counterintuitive of all the religion in the whole wide world. My real estate is not mine, and that problem in Indonesia is mine, because from a Christian frame, I would say I love my neighbor. And I was commanded to care for creation. And so, I don't know. I think we're kind of splitting hairs. How we get there, I don't think the problem is how are we going to solve this problem. If we motivated all of just even America to say, understand that, you know, we're hanging, the earth is this ball hanging from a thread that is unraveling and we're all on it. And the people here all want to make it better. We're all going, oh, my God, what are we going to do? And then there's those dumb jerks that are jumping up and down, right? And how do we calm them down? Well, if science was going to calm them down, it would have done that already. So let's see if we can't heal the estrangement that they feel. I mean, the people that are zealots and difficult and anti-education, anti-intellectual, they're feeling pretty alienated. So what's the answer? To stop hating them and start healing them and including them and listening to them. And when you bring everybody into the fold and everybody says, you know, whether or not your home floods or your kid is, you know, we have incredibly high asthma rates in Tennessee because TVA burns so much coal and we're in a bowl with mountains and kids are dying. In Knoxville, Tennessee, we have one of the highest asthma death rates for children in the country. You know, that's a moral argument, and it shouldn't have to be my kid for me to get it. So once we're all running in the same direction, then I think, and we talk to churches about what can you do as an individual Christian, what can you do as a congregation. Once they have figured out what they can do, they've had an energy audit at home, they've had one at church, they've gotten rid of their styrofoam cups and they've looked at how they're investing their money, then they're ready to be on that citywide task force about how is Knoxville going to be a greener city. And then when Knoxville's a greener city, no matter how slow the legislature is to adopt, and let me tell you, they're pretty slow here in Tennessee, when you've got green cities, which Knoxville and Chattanooga and Nashville are all working hard to be, sooner or later the state legislature has to listen. And if the Tennessee state legislature gets green, do you think we'll start signing international treaties? Absolutely. So that, to me, is how we get a hold of this problem. We do what we can do, and we look at the people who can do more, and we support and encourage those efforts. And I don't think we have to know exactly how we're going to solve the problem. My approach has always been, you just do everything. I mean, we're hanging from that damn thread, after all. You know, I mean, it may not help that somebody quit smoking much, but, you know, quit smoking anyway. You know, that's where I'm looking at what folks said. But that's, greed is central, and separation is central.
Either of you want to say anything more?
So, two things. One on the ownership question. I actually think that's really interesting, and it's not something that's really present in a lot of the philosophical literature. And just thinking about it, you know, thinking about Jefferson talking about it this way, well, if you go back sort of from, you know, the philosophical inspiration of the founders, which everybody wants to go back to John Locke, you know, the libertarians often say this is the argument where we get these absolute property rights. And, you know, I think if you read Locke and if you read other people, you actually can build really good arguments that say no, because even Locke, who thinks that ownership is very powerful and sort of gives you a right to do whatever you want, says you still have to leave enough for other people. You can't take property and not leave enough for other people. And so when you start to understand that the earth needs to continue over generations, if you read something like even Locke-in, people who want to ground it in this strong claim to property ownership, it just seems like you can't really get sort of the good foundation there. And then the second thing, I think that the sort of the individual action, like I agree on that. My worry with the moral argument is then once you get to the point of legislation is if you have a one sort of moral argument versus another, you might be sitting here saying, well, this moral argument says cap and trade. This moral argument says complete, get rid of all of this stuff and do this. And that's where, for me, there's the worry about needing to think more about the moral argument in terms of that bigger legislative picture. But I think the moral argument at that basic level tells all of us as citizens to act and then go scream at legislators to at least have the conversation about what policy you would then be putting in place. But that's where I think the split or the maybe the unhelpfulness is right now, because there is a lot of dispute over which is the moral policy position.
Well, I think those are good points. I think that it is a conflation of the moral argument for action with a specific set of policies being moral or not moral. And obviously, a great many of the people who deny climate science really deny it because they hate the solution, or they hate their idea of what the solution has to be, which they think is big government and regulations. And the irony, of course, is going to be that if we don't take action on climate change, that's going to really require big government, because then in a world that's being ravaged by climate, democracy really requires abundance. If you go to a world of scarcity where there's only so much land and only so much fresh water and only so much food, that is typically when you see, authoritarian or totalitarian regimes who are basically dividing up, telling people, you can live here, you can't live here, you're going to get this, you're not going to get this. So, the world 30 years from now, if we don't take action on climate change, is going to be far more of a conservative nightmare than the modest steps one needs to deal with this issue. The last thing I like the distinction between the human rights argument and the fairness argument. I think that in some sense this is the last of the human rights arguments. This is the human rights of future generations. And this, by the way, goes directly into the economic argument, because the central economic analysis argument is what discount rate do you use? That ends up being, the economists will say, well, the future is going to be richer than we are, and they're going to have a lot more options. So we have to, we value money. You'd much rather have $100 now than $100 in 100 years, which is obviously the case. But is a human being in 100 years worth any less than a human being today? And is the soil any less valuable? So, once you move into the realm of intergenerational human rights, then you get to saying, well, the discount rate really should be zero. Mm-hmm. And there are people who make this argument. Well, once the discount rate is zero, then it's obvious that the cost of action is considerably cheaper than the cost of inaction. And the only way you can ever show that the cost of inaction is cheaper than the cost of action is if you have a very large discount rate, a discount rate comparable to the way corporations act, but obviously corporations, even though they're supposedly people, they don't have to get health care and they don't have a lifetime. I will make one point about the fairness argument, because one of my cousins is an expert on 19th century American history, and he writes a lot about the abolitionists. And we were talking about actually doing a joint article on some of the similarities and difference between the abolition movement and climate change. And interestingly, he said the fairness argument was one of the ones that was the strongest in the abolition movement, and that was someone not getting paid for their work. And which I think says to me that the human rights argument will appeal to a certain set of people, but fairness may be the moral argument that wins with other people. There may be an overlap, but some people may think, well, human rights, you know, that's, right. You know, that's just too abstract for me. But fairness, that's, you know, I can get that. So I think, you know, it's, one has to figure out who you're talking to, who you're making the argument to, as to which is going to be more persuasive, and you might be talking to them and you might find, boom, they think the fairness argument is like really important, or they may agree to say, you know, who cares about fairness, but the human rights.
Okay.
And can I add in one last thing?
Okay, very quickly. So look at all those hands.
It's a resource for them. So Joe was just talking about the idea that democracy seems to need abundance. And so if we get a climate-ravaged world, it's going to look really bad, and we might need a much stronger, more powerful state. And so there's a book that was published by a philosopher named Tim Mulgan. It's called Ethics for a Broken World. And I do want to note that I myself have not read the entire thing. I'm familiar with Mulgan's general position and his arguments. But from the reviews and other things that I've seen discussed on in various discussion boards, the book basically takes the perspective of, okay, what's the world going to look like if things go bad, and how do we need to reconceive our ethical thinking and our moral reasoning? And so he's kind of getting at that, and one of the points that's pushed there is, it looks like we may need something more like the Hobbesian, really strong sovereign, and that would not be the lovely democracy that we all think is so great. So that would be a potential resource, and my impression is it's not written solely for philosophers, that it is more of a general audience book. So,
great. Okay. In front, and say your name, please, and your affiliation.
I'm a Jewish writer out of Nashville, Tennessee. In the late 60s, my mother quit buying grapes because Chavez was agitating for workers' rights in California. Not a whole lot of skin in the game, not a big sacrifice. When I was in college in the early 80s, apartheid was a huge cause. I didn't miss a beat. There was no sacrifice. In my opinion, to really make change individually on global warming, I need to move to my farm, have no electricity, live the way my great-great-grandparents lived. I really believe that. That's the sacrifice I have to make from a religious perspective, a philosophical perspective. Collectively, how do you get people to come together and everyone contribute in that way? Because in my opinion, and the poorest in this country live better than 90% of the rest of the world. How are you going to convince Americans to make those kind of sacrifices to really make change? Recycling is a feel-good gesture, but that's all it is, ultimately. It makes you feel good. I've done my part, so I can go on about my lifestyle, driving my kids all across town for soccer games, et cetera, et cetera.
Okay, so the premise, and you guys may disagree with the premise here, but the premise is, essentially, do we all have to go back to the land, live agrarian, and how will that work?
What I'm reading on the climate science is our footprints are smaller in urban areas, and me living out of town 20 minutes and driving my Prius back and forth is probably way worse than me moving to a condo in downtown Knoxville. So I don't know what exactly the solution is. I totally buy it's going to take dramatic lifestyle change on all of our parts. The way you sell that to people is you begin with buy-in that the problem belongs to all of us. All of us are one. And recycling may seem like fluff or window dressing or changing out your styrofoam cups for coffee in the fellowship hall, but what that is that's buy-in. That is the person saying, it's cheaper for me to buy styrofoam cups and we don't have to have rotate volunteer washers, but I am owning part of the problem that the injury to you is my responsibility. That's step one. You don't jump into the deep end before you learn how to swim. We take baby steps with the people who aren't drinking the Kool-Aid yet. And that's how we begin. And when you start telling them, they feel, people are afraid. The kind of thing we hear, oh, my God, we're going to die anyway. What difference does it make? I might as well have a latte. That is very fear-based and overwhelmed. And hope is the antidote for fear. And so the, you know, can we solve this problem really, or are we just screwed? I don't know. I don't know. Nobody knows. Okay. I don't, I've heard lots of really smart clients say, we may be able to extend the life of the human race. We may not. I mean, from my standpoint, I'm going to do everything I can to be a good steward as I was directed to do. And then at the end, I'm going to leap into the arms of Jesus. Okay. That's where I'm at. And that's a really not a fear-based place. And, you know, everybody dies. Life is a terminal illness. We got to let go of the fear first, and then we can move forward in action that makes sense. And when people are overwhelmed, the other thing that gets, we're talking about fairness. To me, I don't know the difference between loving your neighbor, human rights, and the fairness argument. Those are all the same. If my behavior makes my neighbor sick, demoralizes or impoverishes them, it's a sin. It's wrong. It's wrong whether you're a Christian or not. It's just wrong. So, and that is, you know, you never would have gotten the civil rights movement through the South without the churches. You're not going to solve climate change in the South. You're not going to get buy-in without the churches. So I think that's important here. I wouldn't say if you're from Portland, you try this at home. But maybe, I don't know. It would look a little different in another place. Okay. But I guess what I'm saying is, we don't know if we can solve this problem or not, but we have to have a collective intention to try. It is not going to be distributed fairly. And, you know, I was thinking about the water problem between Tennessee and, you know, I'm sitting here in Tennessee thinking, you want our water? I've been to Atlanta. Y'all are wasting water. You're watering your grass and everything else. And, you know, why do you want our water? You should save your water first. Then they're probably thinking, and, you know, the state of Tennessee is permitting blowing up the headwaters and perpetually of the Cumberland River and perpetually polluting it with selenium. You know, how should we be good to you about water? We're entitled to it. We're better stewards of it than you are. When you go to that level, everybody loses. We need to help our neighbors in Georgia. We need to stop blowing up the headwaters. I mean, there's so many ways to get a hold of this problem. And, you know, when somebody new like Christians step into the fray, some of the environmental groups have gone, there's not enough to go around. I'm like, there's plenty of problems, guys. The odds that we will solve them all are pretty well zero. But I do understand the fear of letting the moral arguments into the conversation, because what I have seen, because we work very closely, as I said, with just really big national environmental groups, there are zealots in religion and in the environmental movement and in politics who would rather be pure and right than make progress. And those are the enemies, you know, you kill the good on the altar of the perfect and the pure. You throw out people who are only willing to have an energy audit to their house, but they're not really sure if climate change is right because they don't believe everything you believe. We can't throw out anybody. So that's kind of what I think about that.
We're going to live in caves?
A couple of things. I think that, you know, we could certainly, you know, reverse a climate change if we wanted to. I mean, it's, you know, I sometimes say it's only money, but when you look at what we did in World War II, I mean, you know, the auto industry was making 3 million cars a year, and in 9 months we stopped making cars and we became the arsenal democracy. And so, but we were in a wartime footing, and we had a war production board, and people recycled their rubber, and they didn't, you know, and so every single person was serious. If we will get to a point when every single person is serious. That's the desperate phase. I had always hoped that there would be a phase where governments were kind of intelligent and got us part of the way there before the desperation kicked in. You know, obviously the behavior change, that usually comes after bad stuff happens. You know, Bill Clinton becomes a vegan after the heart attack. Even after it's the second heart attack, really, that he becomes the vegan. And that's, you know, and so I don't go around, you know, preaching behavior change because I don't think that accomplishes much. And I don't think you have to do that right now. Will you ultimately have to do it? You know, probably. But I think there's an important point to make about this issue of, you know, is it too late? And this is important to understand. It's never too late in this sense. Climate change isn't just we're here and we're going to go there. We're here, we're going to be there, then we're going to be there, we're going to be there, and we're going to be there. And I can tell you that, you know, right now we could possibly stabilize at, let's say, 4 degrees Fahrenheit. And if we are dumb, you know, right now it's sort of a choice between doing nothing, and, you know, that's 7 or 8, 9, 10 degrees Fahrenheit and 4. These are the choices we have. But in 30 years, then the choice will be we're going to have to do a heck of a lot more. We're going to be stuck with more temperature rise. We may be stuck with 5 or 6 Fahrenheit. But then the cost of inaction is we're going to 10, 11, or 12. And, you know, I 7 degrees, 8 degrees Fahrenheit global warming, that's like an unmitigated catastrophe and widespread suffering. But when you get to 10, 11, or 12, now you're talking about a planet that just can't even sustain a billion people, let alone 9 billion. So I think it's important to understand that there will never come a time when dramatic efforts to reverse emissions will not be the best strategy. No matter how much you're spending on adaptation, you're still going to realize, oh, my God, it could still get so much worse. I mean, it can get so hot on this planet that you've actually passed the human tolerance of heat. And that's when it warms about 15 degrees Fahrenheit. And then you literally can't go outdoors for more than like 15 minutes, particularly if you're in a humid area. And you know, and there's been studies on this. So the point is, yeah, it's inaction now is immoral. You can't say inaction in 30 years will also be immoral. It'll be a different, you know, different kind of infinity, if you will, but it will be still immoral and we will still want to have collective action in 30 years, even if we do nothing for the next 30 years.
Dennis Dimmick, National Geographic. So the question is, this is an intergenerational challenge. How do you inspire the generations coming up to take action?
I think they're the easiest. I've actually written and done children's sermons on this. And one, for example, you know, mountaintop removal coal mining is a great example because it's so easy to understand. And one of the children's sermons, I think it's on the website, you take a bucket of flowers, like potted plant with flowers, and you take the flower. This is you do at home. You don't do this in front of the kids. And under it, you put a big couple, three handfuls of coal, and then you put flowers back on top so it looks like a potted plant. So you take it up there on the altar, and you say, well, kids, aren't these pretty? Yeah, we always have altar flowers. We like flowers. It makes us feel good. And they're part of the natural world, right? Yeah. Okay. And then you say, there's some coal in there. And if we don't get it out, we can't keep the lights on or make the coffee or, you know, play the music that you like to dance to. So we've got to get it out. How should we get it out of there? And they're going, can we put a little hole in the side and pull it out? Can we, you know, no, maybe we should just leave it in there. Should we just leave it in there? I think the kids like, they want to leave it in there. I go, well, let's get it out the way the coal miners get out. Just dump it. You know, turn the whole thing upside down and go, well, y'all pick it up. They won't pick it up. They're horrified. They're going, ah! That's just the meanest thing in the world. And I'm going, you know, I already knew I had y'all. It's those old farts in the back I'm getting right now. But, you know, when you do something stupid, you have to reveal it in a graphic. The kids intuitively know this. Their problem is that their parents, and particularly their grandparents, don't know this. And I would agree with what Joe said about, you know, who says the present value of a human 100 years from now is not the same. I mean, when we were directed to love our neighbors, it wasn't time limited. I think people are equally important. I don't think that's a hard point to make. So I find kids to be simple. And that they adopt the norm that is around them. They like mold to fit the container they're given.
Go ahead. I wouldn't mind hearing from Leo, actually, but go ahead.
A couple of things in terms of what you were saying about kids understand this. You know, I have a 6.5-year-old. What's the number one lesson that you teach kids? It's sharing. And then the second is put stuff back the way you found it. You know, it's only adults who don't share, you know, who don't want to share what they have. Kids, and we just implore our kids to share and to think of the other person, be empathic, and like I said, leave things the way you found them. But as adults, we don't do any of those things. I mean, it's really beyond embarrassing. When I talk to young people, the first thing I always do is apologize, because, you know, it's... what we're doing is so immoral that it's someone at least has to apologize for what we're doing. I also, you know, a lot of times when I talk to young people, they don't have political power. I mean, it's great if they become politically active, but, you know, I usually just tell them they need, you know, there are a lot of people who would like to not think about this because, oh, it can't be solved and, you know, we're all going to die anyway. But this is the world they're going to inherit. And lots of decisions that they have to make are going to be affected by this. You know, does your family own coastal property? Is your parents going to retire in South Florida? Or are they going to retire to Arizona? You know, other places that are going to be uninhabitable. Deal, to me, it's not what I'm trying to do. I'm just trying to say, it is immoral not to tell people what you think the science says about the future, because every single person in this room makes decisions about how they think the future is going to be. And the more, you know, that's why we have weather forecasters, you know, and this notion that telling people what the future climate going to be is immoral. That's the same argument as I'm not going to tell you that I have a 90% confidence that a hurricane is going to make landfall, you know, 5 miles from your home. That's not immoral. You expect me to tell you that if I know it. So I just think that it requires a true arrogance to assume that there's information that I can possess that I can't share with you because you can't handle the truth. You know, I don't believe that. I think everyone in this room goes about their lives knowing bad stuff's going to happen in the future, and yet you still go through your lives. So this notion that I can't tell you, you know, bad things may happen in the future if we don't do X, Y, and Z. Doctors tell you this all the time. Your parents tell you this all the time, you know. So I just think I don't think information is enough. Don't get me wrong. It is, and that's why we're talking about the moral argument. But the basis of the moral argument is our best estimate of what the heck's going to happen in the future if we don't act.
And to add to that, I actually think that the information is part of the moral argument. So I think part of the moral argument and part of acting to solve it is that we have an obligation to share this information and do this. And I think that's potentially the way to inspire without the feeling of being paralyzed, is highlight that you don't have to go, you know, crazy green or live off the grid or try to be, you know, self-sustaining, that you just need to talk. You need to, when you hear someone say, oh, this isn't happening, and you have information that says it is, you should share it, right? And you should tell people this, and you should talk about it. And then I think the other biggest part is it goes back to the apologizing. It's accepting responsibility. And because I think the most paralyzing thing is probably when you see something and you think that what's really morally problematic was how other people acted, and that their attitude towards it is, we're not going to change anything about it. I don't see anything wrong. Your problem, right? And so I think the best way to inspire is to say, we made a mistake and we're going to try to start helping. And unfortunately, we can't do it, but you know, there are those little things you can do. And I think it really is, it's pointing out that even the moral argument can be read as not, you have a moral obligation to stop climate change. You have a moral obligation to act in those little ways. And framing it that way, because then you don't feel sort of like, oh my gosh, I've got to fix climate change. You feel like, I have to talk to people. I have to, when I'm presented with a chance, I need to do something. And I think that people feel less paralyzed with.
Great. Pam, Psalm? So the question is, kids are easy, old farts, legislators, and corporations are hard, partly because it takes a lot of money. How do we leap that?
So this goes back to a lot of the academic work that I'm interested in doing relates partially to recognizing that we're entrenched in a problem because of sort of certain power dynamics. And I think that the fact that the kids are easy, that might be the way to go. Because if you live in a democracy, it takes money, it takes these things, but if you get enough people who will speak up, who will write a letter, who will do something, that has an impact. If you get enough kids in a generation who won't buy from a certain company because of their behavior, that can get that impact. And so I think that potentially part of it is recognizing, and not necessarily writing off sort of older generations or corporations, but saying that maybe the way to really get them is to, one, spread that moral argument. Really hit them with the fact that it's not about bottom line, it's not about money. And then, two, get them to start to see that if they don't listen to it, there is actually going to be an impact for them. And I think that's a case where what ends up happening is there's more of a responsibility then to be engaged as a citizen in a democracy. And I think that's been democracy and try to fight the money. And maybe the money still wins because corporations are people and they can do stuff. But if you get enough voices there, the politicians would have to, I think, start to listen a little bit.
I think everything Alex says is right. I think, Pam, when you say, you know, how do we morally address this? Well, let's look. Part of the problem is we have in order to cure climate change, we may not have to cure, but we at least have to address our estrangement from all things that are intangible, because we only live in a material world. If you can't count it, it doesn't count. So spiritual and emotional relationships with the natural world are discounted, and you get looked at funny when you talk about them. But also our power structures are wrong. I mean, if the very first year I had shown up, which had been about 7 years ago, in the Tennessee State Legislature, I had had $300,000, which is less than the cost of a swanky vacation house in the Cumberland Plateau that we're trying to save, I would have passed this bill. If I had four and y'all didn't cover it until I was finished, I could pass this bill the next session. All right? If you covered it, then the coal industry would bring in $1 million, and then somebody would have to give me $1.5 million, and, you know, that's kind of how it works. But